Hello and welcome to the Anonymous Anthropologist Podcast with your host, the Anonymous Anthropologist. That's me. I am a community college professor of anthropology with more than 10 years of teaching in the classroom and a master's degree from Columbia University. I'd happily tell you more about me if only I could be sure that it wouldn't get me fired. Hello, everyone, and welcome to the podcast. I am the Anonymous Anthropologist, here with you today to talk a little bit about homosexuality. I think a lot of you have been waiting for me to get around to this particular topic. First, I'd like to thank you for hanging in there during this absence of several weeks. I did take a break for quite a while from the podcast so I could be with my family to celebrate the holidays and the start of the new year. And I hope everyone out there had a great holiday season, took a little time off from work if you were able to. If you were not able to take any time off, then I want to thank you for getting up and going to work every day and helping to keep the country running. I do appreciate that. Thanks to all of my listeners for being patient, waiting for me to get back to the podcast. And this today is, I guess it's your reward. Right up front here, I should probably say that this podcast is not safe for work, and it's probably not safe for young children either. We are going to be talking about sex and sexuality, and I might throw in a few cuss words. I sometimes do that when talking about these topics. So keep this one to your adult selves. Homosexuality is, of course, a tremendously broad topic, and it's not something I can hope to cover by any means in a single half-hour podcast. So what I'm going to do today is just begin the discussion. I have to begin this conversation, and I use that word optimistically in the hope that people will call in and write in. I have to begin this conversation by reminding my listeners that I am a lesbian, I am a gay woman, I am a homosexual, whatever word you choose to use. Back in the day when I was politically active and marching on the streets because my friends were dying of AIDS, I was a dyke. I was a big, fat dyke. And I was definitely out there marching, we're here, we're queer, get used to it. Not because of any reason other than that I was watching my friends die. And I think that that is what politicized my generation. Right about the time that I graduated high school and would have been ready to enjoy my sexual liberation, the world became very fearful of AIDS. And back then, it was a gay disease and it was a death sentence. As a New Yorker, as a performer, I came into contact with very, very many gay friends and watched them suffer. So yes, I was out there marching with my friends. I think that that was really the turning point for American society, because until the crisis of AIDS, gay people didn't really have a lot of anger. We were busy being defensive. But when we saw the country ignore the plague because it only seemed to affect gays, we were thoroughly outraged, outraged enough to get out and march and be loud and do sit-ins and demonstrations and some pretty outrageous things, some of us. But it was necessary. So I think that's really the turning point for our culture in America when several things happened. So for one thing, lesbians and gay men became friends because prior to then, there wasn't really much overlap or socializing between the two communities. But lesbians could not stand by and watch our gay brothers be the casualties in this apocalypse. So we stood up right alongside them and we formed ties that we enjoy today. And this is really, I think, what explains the rise of the LGBTQ acronym, which pulls all of us together, lesbians, gays, bisexuals, transgendered folks, and folks who are just questioning, into one big, happy, deviant family. And I mean deviant in the dictionary sense of the word, as in not practicing behavior that is the norm. The other thing that happened is that free sex lost a lot of its appeal, and people began getting more serious about committed relationships where they could feel physically safe. And I do think that this had a lot to do with the following 20 or 30 years of activism that have led us to where we are now with regard to the issue of gay marriage, for example. Back in the 1970s, I don't think there were very many homosexuals who wanted to be married. I don't think that was what it was about, especially among men. AIDS changed us a lot. So I am a lesbian who's been through that kind of a past, which means that I have opinions, of course. that I might not share with some of my listeners. So I ask your indulgence and your patience and your understanding, and I'd like you to put on your little cultural relativism hat that you have to wear when you do anthropology and just hear me out with an open mind and, then make up your own mind. Now, I might say a few things here in this podcast that might surprise you. I think that my take on homosexuality is a little bit different from my gay and lesbian friends because of my background in anthropology. That causes me to look at it typically from a cross-cultural and historical perspective. So when I think about homosexuality in general, I can't help but look at it across the globe, around the world, throughout time, and ask questions from that point of view. Academic folks like to begin conversations about things like homosexuality by doing what we call defining our terms. So what do we mean by homosexuality? Well, I'm sure most of my audience understands that that's an attraction between people of the same sex. A person is homosexual when they are attracted to people of the same sex in terms of having sex with them. This is something totally separate from how you feel about your own sex, whether you feel male or female, and how you feel about your gender, which we talked about as your social role, the way you want to act in the world. These are all separate things. In previous podcasts, I have talked about the development of your sexual characteristics in utero and beyond, and then I went on to discuss what gender is from a cultural perspective. So today, I'm just talking actually about the act of having sex and with whom you choose to do so, for the most part. So it's understood then that homosexuality is about attraction between people of the same sex. It's from the Greek word homo, which means same, and that's with a little h, a lowercase h. If you use a capital H, you're using the Latin word homo, in which case it means human or man. So we're with the Greek meaning here, homosexual. Now, the fact is that homosexuality as a word, as a category, did not even appear in print until the middle to late 1800s. The first appearance of the term is from an obscure reference from the late 1860s. It was a German pamphlet by an Austrian-born writer who was actually writing at the time an argument against anti-sodomy laws. So in that pamphlet in 1869, it was in that pamphlet, he used the word homosexual, and this was actually in German. So homosexual, not sure how you say it. It came into generalized use when it entered the realm of science under the auspices of a gentleman named Richard von Krafft-Ebing, who is very, very famous to those of us who have studied the history of psychology and the history of something called sexology. Here I want to make my first major point. The idea of homosexuality, as we conceive of it, has always in our culture been a diagnosis, a label, for some, a pathology, a problem. It came into use in our society because we needed a cultural label for people who deviated from the norm of sexual relationships. Prior to the very late 1800s, homosexual behavior throughout the Western world was considered a form of criminal deviance and was usually punished through the legal system. But in the late 1800s, we saw the rise of a brand new branch of science, which we now know as psychology, which really didn't exist the way we know it today until then. It's the science of psychology as a subfield of medicine that, starting in the late 1800s, went about the process of categorizing a taxonomy, a sort of organization of mental illness. Before psychology began looking at culturally deviant behavior as forms of illness, in this case, mental illness, these deviant behaviors were punished as either criminal acts or they were seen as acts of the devil. In any event, people were institutionalized or ostracized, and rarely was there any effort made at anything we could think of as treatment. But the science of psychology has always been, I think, at its root a humanistic and empathetic science, and its goal has been not just the understanding of human mental illness, but the treatment of human mental illness. And there's, I think, because of that, some compassion in the science. So early psychologists who went about the business of diagnosing and defining deviance as a form of mental illness included in that classification scheme homosexuality, which is a behavior. It is an act. It is something that someone does. It really was not invented as a noun. In those days, you did not speak of a homosexual person. You spoke of homosexual behavior. The fact is that these early psychologists who studied sexuality, and the subfield of psychology that studies sexuality is called sexology, the early sexologists were concerned to diagnose deviant sexuality as a form of mental illness in order to promote empathy and understanding by the general public rather than criminalization and prosecution. The most prevalent theory that came forward was the theory of sexual inversion, which held that most people who are what we would think of today as homosexual, they felt as if they were in the wrong bodies. They were somehow sexually inverted. So a woman who was a lesbian attracted to other women was a sexual invert because she was a man trapped in a woman's body. And today we would be more likely to identify this as a form of transgendered identity or perhaps transsexual identity, but not homosexuality. In any event, homosexuals were referred to in the late 1800s, early 1900s as sexual inverts. So the term homosexuality had its origin in the field of sexology, a subfield of psychology, a subfield of medicine, and its purpose was to identify people as not just deviant, but actually ill, mentally ill. Homosexuality was a diagnosis of a pathology, and the prescription was empathy and compassion. For those of you who are curious about this history, I would suggest that you look up the work of Kraft Ebing, that's Kraft-Ebing, and later on Havelock Ellis, probably the two most well-known early sexologists who talked about homosexuality as a form of inversion. Their work is really rather well known among those of us who discovered our sexuality through reading. Many, many lesbians can point to Radcliffe Hall's 1928 novel, The Well of Loneliness. Oh, what memories. The Well of Loneliness. The Well of Loneliness is a very, very well-known book about a sexual invert, a woman who identifies more with the male role and is attracted to other women. And there are a lot, actually, there are a lot of novels from the early 20th century about this phenomenon, and they almost invariably have a tragic ending because society just did not approve of this at the time. So happy endings were not allowed. But at any rate, many a lesbian has read The Well of Loneliness on the path to discovering her own identity. And that is a classic example of the attitude that society had toward these sexual inverts. It was supposed to be an attitude of tolerance and perhaps even pity because, you know, they could never have normal lives. Now, I'd like to ask the question, why is it that there's no mention of any of this sexual inversion or homosexuality in Western literature or Western culture until almost the beginning of the 20th century? What is that about? It's pretty interesting to me. So let's go back and think about it. What was the attitude? We already talked about that. What was the attitude toward homosexuality? Well, it was something you didn't discuss. It was completely forbidden. It was criminal deviance. It was punishable by the law. And God, of course. But suddenly, just before the turn of the 20th century, it became an illness. It became something that maybe you weren't responsible for, something that might be, I don't want to say it was okay, but perhaps understandable, maybe even tolerable. Well, it's my contention that this happened because homosexuality was finally possible. What do I mean by that? I'm not saying it was finally possible to have sex with someone of the same sex. That's, you know, sexuality in its most pure form. What I'm saying is it became possible to live a homosexual lifestyle. Oh, that's a completely different thing. You know, I think there are a lot of people who have had homosexual experiences who, you know, maybe they could go there or maybe they have gone there, but it was just a one-shot deal, or, you know, just a short-lived thing. It wasn't who they were. It wasn't something they were willing to commit to as a lifestyle. I will tell you on a personal note that my very first sexual experience as a lesbian was with a dear friend. And to this day, I am the only woman she has ever been with. She is not even bisexual. She is a rabid, happy, heterosexual woman. But she was my first, and I was her first, and it was lovely and wonderful. And yes, you're welcome for all that sharing. But maybe that's, you know, we allow that with women, right? Guys like that. They get turned on when they hear about women getting together like that. So, gentlemen, you're welcome. You're less inclined to want to listen to a story about how this happens between men, but I think many of you know that it does. It does, it does. There's lots and lots of evidence for homosexual behavior between men, and things like prison and in the armed forces, and, you know, under certain circumstances, it's okay. And the truth is that in certain cultures, it's not having sex with another man that makes you gay. It's whether you're the top or the bottom. That's what matters. Roger N. Lancaster, his 1994 book, it's called Life is Hard, Machismo, Danger, and the Intimacy of Power in Nicaragua. That's a great book for this particular topic if anybody wants to follow up. Read that book and you'll see that, according to Lancaster, there are places in Nicaragua where sex between men is not a big deal. Again, what matters is whether you're the pitcher or the catcher, as we say. If you are on top, if you are the person delivering, then you could be doing that to a woman. You are still in charge. You are still macho. What makes you feminine is receiving, being a sexual receiver. That reduces you to the position of the female, which is very much less than macho. And so that's what is disdained. That's the identity that is disparaged. And I think that's true to some extent of prison sex, from what I've heard at any rate. That if you are on top, it means you are the dominator, you are in charge, you are the aggressor, and if you are the bottom, then you are somebody else's bitch. So there is plenty of incidental homosexuality among so-called heterosexual people. Absolutely, it happens. And I truly believe that in traditional society, it's generally ignored as long as it's not the only thing you're trying to do. In other words, there's almost always the requirement that you marry and start a family. That exists in almost every culture. And if you do that, if you fulfill the biological imperative to reproduce and carry on the culture, then what you do on your own time is pretty much your own business because, let's face it, it's of no consequence. It makes no babies. Think back to the podcast on gender where I talked about the sexual division of labor. And I explained that for various reasons, there's always what we think of as men's work and women's work. And because there is this division of labor, it becomes necessary for men and women to establish families, to establish cooperative relationships, so that they can reproduce and provide the children with everything that is necessary in that culture. So what happens as a consequence of the Industrial Revolution is that in the late 1800s, early 1900s, right about the time we're talking about with the rise of psychology and the sexologists, the sexual division of labor suddenly becomes less of a barrier. In other words, little by little, at this point in our history, men start living lives separate from women. And in some cases, women are able to live lives separate from men. It's also around the same time we see the rise of what's called the Boston marriage, wherein women form close relationships and share their lives together in the same house. The times were so repressive, there is, of course, never any explicit talk of sex, but it's clear that these women built their lives together to the near exclusion of men. Why were they able to do this? Well, we're talking about New England in the early 20th century. They came from prominent, wealthy families who supplied them with enough money to be able to live on their own. Or they were artists or writers, or they had something that they could do to support themselves. Because remember, this is a time before women really went to work. So it actually became possible for women to build their lives without men, which, if you'll reflect again back to that podcast on gender, you'll realize is a new thing in the Western world. As for the history of gay male culture in this country, well, there's a treasure trove of research and just a tremendous wealth of gay scholars out there, and there's a lot of reading to be done if you're interested. But my brief gloss on it from this anthropological perspective is that, once again, because of the capitalist-industrialist mode of production, it became possible for men to live apart from women and to form lives on their own. Think about it. When we were in an agricultural mode of production, when you were a farmer, this was a family enterprise. You absolutely needed to stick together. You needed the labor. There was really no way out of this unless you were able to become some kind of merchant or trader, perhaps. But most people required a spouse to make their clothes, etc., etc. The Industrial Revolution gave rise to cities as men were pulled away from their hometowns in order to work in the factories and other forms of industry. And in these cities, we saw the rise of services for these single men, tailors and laundromats and restaurants and things like that. And so the mode of production both demanded that men leave their homes and their families and made it possible by providing the services which were otherwise provided by their wives and families. So again, it's not that it suddenly became possible in the early 20th century, late 19th century, to be homosexual, as in to have sex with people of the same sex, but that it became possible to live a homosexual life and socialize almost exclusively with people of the same sex, to live alone outside of the institution of heterosexual marriage. And I think when I reflect back to that first relationship with my dear friend, that was really the choice that she made. It wasn't about whether or not she was sexually attracted to women, but whether or not she wanted to live that quote-unquote lesbian lifestyle, to live a life without an attachment to a man. And being, as we know now, a heterosexual woman, that was not a choice that she felt comfortable making. And I think that we could apply this to many of those circumstances of incidental homosexuality. You may well be attracted to someone sexually, but you're certainly not ready to make that choice to live that homosexual lifestyle. That's such a loaded phrase, isn't it? But all I mean to say is to live a life separate from the opposite sex, to not be conventionally married. This is why I say that homosexuality is not a choice. It's an option. It's an option that has become available to us because of this capitalist, industrialist mode of production. And the option is not about whether or not we choose to have sex with members of the same sex. That's not it at all. The option is about our lives. It's about whether or not we choose to have lives independent of members of the opposite sex. And the funny thing is, you know that's ridiculous because we're all engaged with everyone in this industrialized world. And even gay people still engage on a daily basis with members of all sexes and sexualities. Because, hey, that's what capitalism does. My regular listeners may have keyed into the fact that what I'm discussing here is yet another binary opposition. And you all know that I'm not a tremendous fan of those. Binary opposition, that's when there's only two possibilities and they exist at opposite ends of the spectrum from each other with no possibility of compromise. This describes our political system. It describes our system of assigning sex and gender. It describes so much of American culture, of Western culture in general, these binary oppositions. So what I've been discussing here today is a binary opposition between heterosexuality and homosexuality. I only mentioned bisexuality in passing. It's instructive here to take a minute to note that bisexuality often gets mentioned just in passing because it's outside of the binary and it's something that we still have a hard time figuring out how to deal with. I believe that this is yet another artificial, socially constructed binary opposition that does not actually exist in the real world. In other words, just like sex, where the vast majority of people are either completely male or completely female, but there are a fair number whose genetic and hormonal expression lies somewhere in between those poles, so goes it with sexuality. There are people at opposite ends of the spectrum, but there are also people in between. I can refer you here to the work of Dr. Alfred Kinsey, who did his work in, well, mostly the 30s and 40s. So, once again, you know, we're in the early to mid-20th century. Kinsey's best known for what's called the Kinsey Scale and also the Kinsey Reports. He is yet another in the long line of psychologists who specialize in the study of sex. So, yes, another sexologist. Kinsey was very interested in expressions of human sexuality in the United States, predominantly, and so he set about gathering data. His reports were fascinating and enlightening, and a lot of people think they had a tremendous influence on the sexual revolution that followed in the 60s and 70s. But in retrospect, we can look back and see that some of his work was probably tainted by some serious unprofessional behavior. I think the story goes that he was personally involved in the sex research, engaging in sexual activities, monitoring, and in some cases directing the sexual activities, observing the sexual activities of his employees, all in the name of science. I think it will be a long time before any other scientist gets away with a study like that. It does not, however, diminish the importance of his findings or of the impact they then had upon our culture. So what I want to talk about here is what's called the Kinsey scale, because Alfred Kinsey, he had the idea that I'm talking about right now, this idea that human beings have actually a continuum of sexual preference, a range of preferences from exclusively heterosexual to exclusively homosexual. Kinsey decided that he could measure sexual preference on a scale from 0 to 6, which when you include 0 is actually a 7-point scale, where 0 represents the person who is 100% heterosexual, and the Kinsey 6 is 100% homosexual, so they've never had any kind of incidental contact in the other direction. The assumption based on the data, although we could question how he collected that data, is that the great majority of people are Kinsey 0, where they're just exclusively heterosexual. There are a fair number of people who are Kinsey 6, that's exclusively homosexual, but there are an awful lot of people who fall somewhere in the middle. So if you were a bisexual person and you were equally attracted to members of the same sex as you were to members of the opposite sex, then you would be a Kinsey 3. So what that means is that an individual who is, say, a Kinsey 2 could very well be engaged their entire lifetime in heterosexual behavior with a heterosexual preference, but have incidental homosexual contact. If you are, say, a Kinsey 5, or maybe a Kinsey 4, and you tend more towards the homosexual side, you could spend most of your life or part of your life living a homosexual life, and then find yourself attracted to someone of the opposite sex and surprise all your friends and neighbors by suddenly deciding you are quote-unquote straight. No, you know, your gay friends are going to say, oh, he'll never be straight, right? No, you're just somewhere on the continuum between completely straight and completely gay, and honestly, I really think that's where a lot of us sit. I mean, I won't argue with the idea that most of us are fairly heterosexuals, but there are a fair amount of people who are somewhere else on the scale. And that gives rise to what I think is the fluidity of sexuality, the fact that your sexual preference can change during the course of your life. And this is tough because we have so greatly politicized in the idea of heterosexuality or homosexuality. And I always say that we live in a culture that forces us to sort of pick a lane and drive. You know, you can't just straddle the line. You have to pick a lane. And our culture only provides the two lanes, the two choices, straight or gay. And once in a while, you're lucky enough to find a 3-lane highway where you can be bisexual and ride the middle lane. But still, you know, you got to pick a lane. And as I've discussed in previous podcasts, we do tend to be fairly binary in our worldview. You've got to be one thing or the other, and it's hard for us to look at anything as existing on a continuum. And that's, of course, what leads to problems around lots of things, not just sexuality, but skin color and so-called race. And that'll be fun. One day I will do the podcast on what I always have to call quote-unquote race, because it's not real unless you're being persecuted on its basis. It has no basis in biology, really. We'll talk about that another time. Well, there is really just so much more to talk about with regard to this topic of homosexuality. I'd like to continue and discuss the question of where one's sexual preference comes from, the whole nature versus nurture argument. Is there a genetic component to it, or is it just from your culture? And then there is a topic of gay marriage, which is extremely relevant right now. The Supreme Court should be handing down a judgment, I think, sometime this coming summer. So there will certainly be more podcasts on this topic, but this is where I'm going to leave it for now. And thank you all once again for being patient enough to wait for this episode. I have sent out several stickers to several people. I know a couple of you are still waiting. I will get those out in short order. I still have plenty of stickers, so go ahead, drop me a line, and I'll be happy to send them to you. I will even do international postage, no problem. Well, that is all I have for you today, and I look forward to picking up where we left off in the next podcast with these other topics. Do please spread the word about the blog and podcast. It's been a lot of fun watching the listenership grow. I'm thrilled to say hello to my listeners all over the world, not just in the United States and Canada, but it seems I have a devoted group of folks in Australia. So hello to you all, and thank you so much for listening. Thanks to all my listeners in Ireland and Germany and Italy and, oh my, even in Poland and Saudi Arabia and Turkey. Wow, I am just blown away at this thing we call the internet. That's amazing. I would so, so love to hear from you all who are listening to this podcast from outside of North America. As an anthropologist, that just fascinates me. I'm wondering if you are American expatriates who are living overseas, or if you are just interested in this wacky place we call America. I would love to hear from you, and I would love if you all would come up with some suggestions for future shows. As I've said before, I do have a list that I'm going to, but I will eventually run out, and you might start wondering where my crazy new topics are coming from. So if there is a direction you would like me to head in, or a topic you would like me to address, I would just love to hear from you. Drop me an email to theanonymousanthropologist@gmail.com, or give me a message on the phone line at 206-312-3526. Come and visit me at theanonymousanthropologist.com. Wait for the tweets at, well, don't wait for the tweets because I don't tweet all that frequently, but once in a while you will find me tweeting at Anonymous Anthro. That's at Anonymous Anthro. Go ahead and like me on the Facebook page, and you can also communicate with me there. I do see your comments. Thank you all so much for listening. I hope this new year brings you health and happiness and whatever you think of as success. And congratulations, we all appear to have made it through the Mayan apocalypse and also the Christian rapture. So I guess we all have to figure out what comes next, huh? I look forward to speaking with you next time. Till then, take care.
Am I recording?